I'm Carrie Melks. This is number 0366 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes at you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0366. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we talk dirty with Michael Adams, author of In Praise of Profanity.
I'm not a great user of profanity. I started studying slang a long time ago, and I'm not a great user of slang either, but people all around me use slang and profanity, and I operate by the principle that people speak the way they do for a reason, and it's my job to try to find out what the reasons are, so I was prompted to explore profanity.
Pete Geiger, the publisher and editor of the Canadian Farmer's Almanac, is back to talk about the 2017 edition that just came out. What makes this edition so special?
This essentially is the bicentennial edition. Late last year, I had to hunker down, read all of the almanacs, 199 issues, and make notes of all the things I thought were really kind of neat. So you see all kinds of advice about everything from how to take care of bed bugs that was in 1850. In 1834, we talked about not using tobacco. It wasn't good for you. 1850 talked about not having lard and butter, overuse of lard and butter. All kinds of just wonderful advice.
Ross Connolly, who's the owner and publisher of the Hardwick Gazette in Vermont. He's having an essay contest where you can actually win the whole newspaper.
My late wife and I bought the newspaper in 1986. The newspaper was founded in 1889. She died 5 years ago, and so I'm at the point, I'm 71, where I'm ready to retire, and I'm very concerned about the paper being able to continue. And so I decided to try this contest route to see if that might work. And so I thought that perhaps a contest with only a $175 entry fee might entice some people to give it a try.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0366 was Carrie Milks, a theater student from the University of Ottawa. And thank you very much, Carrie, for doing the guest Slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Now, according to police in Oklahoma, a teacher was arrested on a charge of public intoxication after allegedly showing up on the first day of her job under the influence of alcohol. The Wagoner Police Department said that they have arrested 49-year-old Lori Ann Hill after the principal of the Wagoner High School found her in a classroom without pants. In court, Hill pleaded not guilty to a charge of public intoxication. She was booked into jail, and her bail was set at $149. Wow, $149, boy, they really didn't want to keep her around, did they? Anyway, according to the police investigation, the incident unfolded early on Monday morning. Hill showed up for her first day of work while she was intoxicated. She was not wearing pants or shoes. The principal found her sitting in an empty classroom. The police officer who arrived at the scene could smell a strong odor of an alcoholic beverage coming from Hill's breath, and she admitted to drinking orange juice and vodka on her way to work. She also told police that she had vodka in her car, which was in the school parking lot. Oh my. Now, that's a teachable moment. You know, students won't be bringing in an apple for this teacher. It'll be more like apple teenies. Yeah. And still with dropped drawers, passengers and flight attendants of the Virgin American flight were surprised to see a woman show up without pants. Passengers took photos of the woman, who was not identified, as she stood at the ticket counter to collect her boarding pass. The photos show the woman dressed in a beige jacket leaning against the counter as a staff member is seen talking on the phone with a manager. She did not wear any pants, and her black underwear was visible, exposing most of her behind. Virgin America, of course, as you know, encourages all passengers to relax and unwind when flying, and I think this woman clearly took that advice to heart. A photo of the woman was uploaded on Reddit, where it went viral. Yes, but did she make her flight? That's what I want to know. Meanwhile, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, everything happens at Walmart. I even posted a story on Facebook about the amount of crime and violence that takes place at the House of Sam. It's a pretty long read, but an interesting piece, so check it out. Anyway, in the meantime, another Walmart-based story has fallen into my lap. An Ohio shopper captured video of an escaped monkey scuffling with a Walmart employee before being reclaimed by an owner in the store's parking lot. A video posted to Facebook shows the monkey struggling with a Walmart employee by the cart return station in the Lancaster store's parking lot, and a woman, apparently the monkey's owner, runs up and pulls the two apart. "Let him go! Let him go! Let him go! If he bites you, they will put him down," the woman says. The woman and monkey then return to a nearby camper, which the primate apparently escaped from earlier. A Walmart representative said the monkey did not bite the employee, and the woman was grateful to the worker for catching her unusual pet. The Ohio Department of Agriculture said it is working to identify the woman to determine whether she is an Ohio resident, and if so, whether her monkey is properly registered. Yes, they're going ape at Walmart again. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, firefighters in Santa Rosa, California, received a call about a man sitting 70 feet up in a redwood tree drinking beer. When they arrived, neighbors directed rescuers to the top of the tree, but they were unable to spot the man. They then looked in the unnamed man's yard and found him on top of a small water tank where he had apparently fallen. "He was hanging out, from what we were told," said Fire Captain Jack Thomas. "He fell in some form or fashion, bouncing off all of the limbs all the way down." Firefighters and paramedics provided medical aid. In the man's pockets, they found empty, unbroken beer bottles. Apparently, the bottles were in much better shape than he was. Couldn't you just see him hitting every branch on the way down? It's like watching God playing pinball. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? Profanity is a very popular component of our lexicon, but is it a healthy one? Professor Michael Adams is a historian of the English language and the author of In Praise of Profanity. He joins us on the line right now from Indiana. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you, Peter?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for doing this.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So you wrote the book In Praise of Profanity. Are you yourself someone who either uses profanity or are in praise of it, or is in praise of it?
Well, I'm in praise of it now, but I'm not a great user of profanity. I started studying slang a long time ago, and I'm not a great user of slang either, but people all around me use slang and profanity, and I operate by the principle that people speak the way they do for a reason, and it's my job to try to find out what the reasons are. So I was prompted to explore profanity.
You are a historian of the English language, so is profanity something that is more prevalent today than in the past, or is it always the same degree of profanity being used by the general population?
There's two different types of profanity, and they're important at different points in history, at least in the West. I don't know all that much about the East. The old type of profanity was when you used God's name in vain, or you cursed someone. You were doing something that was contrary to a religious principle. That's the old version of profanity, and that bothered people in the Middle Ages, but talking about sex and excrement didn't bother them very much. When you get into the modern period, say the 16th century forward, people become publicly squeamish about those subjects, and there are lots of movements toward, I guess, what you'd call a pure language, and that excludes the type of profanity we use today, or what we think of as profanity today. And so it's difficult to say whether it was used more or less. It was probably used about the same, but the type of profanity we're talking about is different depending on the period.
Okay. Now, I'm a person who doesn't use profanity, but I'm not necessarily bothered by it. But right. There are those who are bothered by it, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure, there are. I've got nothing against that very legitimate response. In America, for instance, well, really worldwide, but we have a large concentration of Mormons in America, and they're very concerned about profanity as a type of social aggression or an uncleanness, and you got to respect that religious belief. But I think it's safe to say that the majority of North Americans let some profanity slip every now and then, even if they're not great users of it. I think it's a stubborn fact of language that requires some attention on our part.
Now, what about children using profanity? Because, there's some question as to when is it okay for a child to drop the F-bomb, or is it ever a good thing for a child to drop the F-bomb? Because I'm assuming that to properly use profanity, you have to know the language to a certain degree, right?
Yeah, you do, and you have to know certain social uses of language in order to use it well. So there's a point at which kids, speaking very broadly, begin to negotiate their social relationships in ways that may make profanity useful. The 3-year-old or the 4-year-old probably doesn't use profanity as well as somebody who's older. But I have to tell this anecdote. My daughter, who just turned 4, watches a show called My Little Pony, and there's a character on that show named Applejack. This is a pony character. She's a Southerner, and she says, and this is a pony joke, what the hey all the time. And we use what the sentences usually to indicate profanity or a euphemism for profanity. So my daughter picked up that signal and something probably from her friends, and when she's surprised by something, she says, what the heck? I mean, you think that's not really profanity, but it's pretty close to one, and she's got the pattern for profanity down. And she looked at me one day and she said, as she often says to me, Daddy, let me tell you something. Sometimes I say, what the heck, but sometimes I just say, what the. And I thought, what a metalinguistic moment for father and daughter, but she's 4 years old and she already gets it in a way that I certainly didn't expect before she started talking to me about it.
Does profanity have any leveling out in social class? Or are more people prone to use profanity with either more or less education, or does that even factor in?
It used to factor in a lot more than it does now. And it used to be allied with vulgarity. People who were vulgar used profanity, and people who were not tended not to. I think actually that's always been kind of a smokescreen, because people of upper classes have used profanity. They just have a license to use profanity that people of a lower class don't, supposedly because they know better what they're doing with language overall. Nowadays, it's pretty well leveled, and I think people of all classes and in all places use a certain amount of profanity, or like you, if not great users, aren't greatly disturbed by it, and it doesn't serve as the same sort of status marker that it once did.
I have to admit, though, there is one category where it does bother me, and
yeah,
that's the person who uses profanity as commas and periods. I know people who use it constantly in their dialogue, and quite frankly, there are some people that I choose not to hang around with because it's like, okay, enough, I get it. You know,
yeah,
the word.
That's a very strange use of profanity. We all do that to some extent. Teachers tend to say a lot. teenagers of a certain age, I'm talking about maybe 10, 20 years ago, tended to insert like as a sort of interruptive or in order to stop, pause for a moment, consider what they were saying. And older people didn't like that tendency either, though they were probably interrupting their sentences with something in the same way. It does take you back when you hear somebody use profanity for that linguistic purpose, probably because it trivializes the profanity. And profanity, the great thing about profanity, one thing to praise about it, is that it's very expressive language. And we use it at times when we've really got no other way to express the enormity of our feelings, often, for instance, our frustration. at something. No other word will do. So it's kind of demeaning to the profanity and its expressiveness to use it in such an unexpressive way.
I love it when it's creatively used. For instance, everyone knows, or at least a lot of people know by going on YouTube, finding that that book, that children's book,
yes,
Go the Bleep to Sleep, which is narrated by Samuel L. Jackson, who, by the way, has got to be one of the classiest uses of profanity ever to come along.
Yeah, I actually saw a YouTube video of Jennifer Garner reading that book, which was clearly meant as a joke because everybody thinks of Jennifer Garner as a very pure person. I have no idea whether she's pure or not, but no one expected her to be reading that book and being profane in that way.
Well, you mentioned that, and that brings up another point. There are people who make the divide between men using profanity and women using profanity.
They sure do, in the same way that women tend to be expected to be more correct in language use than men. And there are lots of examples, I'm afraid, of schools discriminating against girls who are supposed to do without swearing. The boys, of course, continue to swear in the locker rooms and on the sports fields, but women are held to a higher standard. And so I think some people see that as a vestige of sexism, and I think some young women are prone to profanity partly because they're trying to break that barrier down. I mean, I think it's typical of people in certain settings. Boardrooms come to mind. If you're not free with your speech, and if you don't know how to talk to people in a fairly intimate way, you don't get ahead. And if women are in a position different from men, always having to be correct, where correctness isn't really the type of speech that gets you ahead, and they end up always behind. So that's something to keep in mind.
In writing your book, in praise of profanity, what is it you want the reader to take away most from reading your book?
I believe strongly that slang and profanity, which I see as a type of slang now rather than the sort of taboo language it once was, as highly expressive language, and you could think of it as the poetry of everyday speech. I certainly think of slang that way. You don't have to commit yourself to sitting down and writing a poem to use poetic speech. And we all have a certain level of invention in our language. And sometimes we come up with clever things on the fly. Sometimes we create new words with friends that we use for a short period of time, very useful for building solidarity with those friends. And we use, I know it sounds a strange thing to say, but we use language poetically to do those social things. And profanity falls into that category too. It's poetic in its expressiveness. And poets have known that for a long time and have indulged in profanity while no one was looking.
John Oliver on his HBO show swears like the, as a term we used to use, swears like a sailor.
Yeah.
And in his stand-up routine, he has a bit about swearing and he's actually been quoted as saying this in non-stand-up situations and interviews, where he says he doesn't trust anyone who doesn't use profanity, which I guess means he doesn't trust me.
Yeah, well.
But how do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, he's looking for a type of authenticity or honesty in speech, and he may be wrong to think that people who never use profanity aren't somehow being authentic. But I think what he's suggesting, and I think this is true of use of profanity generally, you know, take some risks with me as a speaker. If I can accept you fully, then I can accept your risk-taking. You can accept my risk-taking. We use profanity to form bonds of intimacy and solidarity all the time, and it comes down to being able to walk off the straight and narrow path together. And that's true from sex talk to locker room talk, even to some branding which trades off of profanity. I can't use any of this on the air, but there are brands on the internet and even clothing brands that clearly bring profanity to mind if they aren't directly profane, and that's a way that we build community is through the use of profanity.
The book is called In Praise of Profanity. It's written by Michael Adams. Michael, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program.
Thanks so much for having this chat.
Professor Michael Adams, author of In Praise of Profanity. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0366, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you could order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From the land that brought you maple syrup, poutine, ice hockey, and Pamela Anderson, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Pete Geiger, who is the publisher and editor of the Canadian Farmer's Almanac. We'll also meet the publisher and owner of the Hardwick Gazette in Vermont. He's having an interesting contest where an essay can win the entire newspaper. That's the paper, the building, the equipment, the whole kit and caboodle. That's all coming up a little later on. We do have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on as well. Plus, we have a lot more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. A Washington State driver's dash cam recorded the moment a woman got out of her car at a red light and was run over by her own vehicle. The footage recorded by David Alger's dashboard camera at the red light to get out of the Costco parking lot in Burlington shows a woman driving a white vehicle ahead of Alger. The video shows another driver pull up beside the woman and signal her that her gas cap is loose. She just went to pick up the gas cap and realized the car was moving, so she went back to jump into her car and grab the steering wheel, Alger said. And as she grabbed the wheel with the car still moving forward, I would imagine the wheel turned to the left, and that's when she was dragged underneath the left rear tire and run over. Both legs went right up over her buttock and both legs. Alger, who is seen running to help the woman, said she insisted she wasn't injured. She wanted to take off after the vehicle and run through the intersection, and I said, "Whoa, hold on here. How are you? Let me help you. Hold on to me." And she said, "I'm fine. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm fine." Alger said the woman drove away after being checked out by police and paramedics. Okay. PRND. Learn what those letters mean on your steering column and use them wisely. And by the way, you can see the video as I've posted the original YouTube version on the Stuff File fan page on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thestufffileprogram and enjoy. Don't forget to like the Stuff File fan page as well. Just click the button, like, click it. Okay, for this next story, I have to give full disclosure. Early in my career, I spent 2.5 years living in the Brockville, Ontario area. So sadly, this story doesn't really surprise me. Two Ontario women got some advice from police on neighborly harmony after a dispute between the two neighbors saw volleys of dog feces being flung across the property line. Police in Brockville say the altercation started last Thursday when one woman found what she believed was her neighbor's dog's excrement in her yard. They say the woman then threw the feces into her neighbor's yard. Police say the dispute escalated when the neighbor replied in kind, throwing handfuls of dog droppings back. Then the confrontation got physical as the neighbors grabbed hold of one another. Police say they gave the women advice on how to get along in the future and suggested they stay away from each other. Well, which one is it? Getting along or staying away from each other? Because to me, those two options are diametrically opposed. They just need to get their excrement together. Yes. Ah, the wonders of Brockville. 2.5 years of my life I'll never get back. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes. We have time for one more story here before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We start off this next story with a quote, and you'll be able to guess right away how fast this story goes downhill. Here's the quote. "He doesn't harm the pigs," says hog farmer Megan Frey of Manor Township, Pennsylvania. "I think it's more we're worried about his safety," she says, "and any diseases he might bring into the hog house." Yes. But yes, she says 64-year-old Larry W. Henry was found in the hog house without any clothes on. Again. When police asked him why he was there, he simply replied, "I just like pigs." Police noted in their report that Henry was drinking beer. Care to guess what brand he was drinking? Yep, it was Hams. Henry was ordered not to trespass on Megan's property the last time he was convicted of the same thing, so this time he was arrested. So, he likes to spend time naked with pigs while drinking Hams beer. Good thing he doesn't drink Schlitz malt liquor Bull. Anyway, let's get to our next guest, shall we? It's late August. The summer is winding down, the nights are getting cooler, kids are preparing for back to school, and the latest edition of the Canadian Farmer's Almanac is now out. The 2017 edition is available. This is a publication that has been going strong since 1818. And every year, millions of faithful readers seek out the down-home wit, wisdom, and proven advice that has made the Farmer's Almanac a household name. On the line with us, as he is every year, is Pete Geiger, the publisher and editor of the Canadian Farmer's Almanac. He joins us on the line from Maine. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Pete. Hi, Pete. Back, I guess.
Thanks for being on the program.
Yes, thank you very much. It's always a joy to talk to you every year. It kind of gives me hope that there's a future here.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Now, I noticed, and mine came in the mail like clockwork, and I love going through it, but I noticed in the little flyer, the little press release that came with it, it says, Special Collector's Edition. Now, this has been out since 1818. First of all, I always thought they were all Special Collector's Editions, but what makes this one more special?
Well, this essentially is the Bicentennial Edition. And so for the last 10 years, I've been saying to Sandy every year, okay, we got to think about what we're going to do for the 200th edition. And we kept saying it and kept saying, well, yeah, we got time, we got time. Well, finally, late last year, I had a hunker down, read all of the almanacs, 199 issues, and make notes of all the things I thought were really kind of neat. So you see all kinds of advice in the Canadian Farmer's Almanac and in the American Farmer's Almanac about everything from to how to take care of bed bugs, that was in 1850, to advice for women. And basically it said to women that they should not be frivolous with men. They should have an education. They should have a talent, so that just getting married shouldn't be the only thing they do. In 1834, that we talked about not using tobacco; it wasn't good for you. 1850 talked about not having lard and butter, overuse of lard and butter. All kinds of just wonderful advice. That when what's so special about it is I look at 200 years and I see how Americana grew and changed and how we changed with it.
But by the same token, are you kind of surprised when going back over the 200 years of the Farmer's Almanac, are you surprised at how some of the things have stood the test of time?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's what really interests me, is that a lot of the things we said were very practical, and have stood the test of time, and because I think the almanac was so practical, that I think that so many people say to me, my grandparent read the almanac. Well, they read it when they were young people and helped them raise their families. I think the millennial group that's coming through now is very ripe for the almanac because it's actually more dangerous than it's ever been. The foods are tainted. We don't know where they're grown. There's chemicals being used. And I think you've got a generation, and it's certainly true for Canadians, maybe more so than Americans. I could be wrong on that. But people want to have a little bit of earth. They want it to know how to do things. They don't want to have chemicals. They want to be, you know, good partners to what's going on. And there's more people that we got to share the earth with. So, I think we have survived for 200 years because we've been relevant, or we wouldn't have survived. And the big question now is when people are not necessarily buying books but are going online, well, are we still relevant? Well, we are because we are online. We have 1,200,000 Facebook followers. We have Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, every way that you want to touch us and reach us or us reach you, it can be done. The book is still orange and green. It's in stores. We just came out this week, so I'm hoping that somebody will go out and buy the book. But there are many, many ways to touch and be affected by us, including we have a newsletter that comes out every Wednesday. We have 250,000 people that get an electronic newsletter from us for free of charge. So I think what's exciting, you're always scared about the future, but I think what's exciting about the future is there's more options, more opportunities for us to still be relevant. And I think there's a generation coming along that I think is going to be very interested in for example, chickens. We have an article about having chickens. I saw an article in our local paper a couple weeks ago about people wanting to have chickens, chickens as pets, chickens for eggs, chickens for food. And so we have a story about that. We have a story that deals with lots of things that are of interest, whether you're in a city or not. It's the Farmer's Almanac is very, very relevant.
Well, one of the things the Farmer's Almanac is always known for, besides the stories, is, of course, the weather, and I'll get to that in a moment. But I want to get to, just looking through some of the things that are in this particular edition, the 2017 edition of the Almanac, the one I like, How to Quiet a Fussy Child, and it involves molasses and feathers. I mean...
what year that was, but back in the 1800s, you would put molasses, if your child was fussy, you put molasses on their fingers, and then you put feathers, and they would spend all their time pulling the feathers off the molasses, and then when they fell asleep and they woke up again, you do it all over again. So apparently, that was a technique for keeping your children occupied and quiet. But I think that was a fun one.
And that was, I believe, 1878, and you know nowadays...
Okay.
The thing that's frightening is if you mentioned feathers and molasses to an adult, it's an entirely different thing. Entirely different thing. Speaking of which, you also have a story from 1896 about the art of kissing.
Yes, and basically the moral of the story is don't be in a hurry. Don't peck a woman on the forehead or on the nose or jerk at her bonnet. Now take the left hand of the young lady in your right. Let go of your hat. Let it just drop. Throw your left hand over the woman's shoulder. Let it fall down to her waist. Draw her gently and lovingly to your heart. Don't be in a hurry. And all throughout the article, just don't be in a hurry.
You know, those are the same
words. We're in such a hurry nowadays.
Those are the same words in Harlequin romance books, by the way.
Is that right? Don't be in a hurry. Just get there eventually.
Now,
the moral to the story. It's all six all-natural homemade garden fertilizers. Things that you can do. You don't have to spend money on. And then I really like the one about 12 wives' tales for predicting a baby's gender. And when I was young, I know you put a pin on a string, and if it went one way, it was a boy, and another way, it was a girl. But now we have 12 of these things. And if a baby's heartbeat is above 40 beats per minute, it's a girl. If it's 140 beats per minute, it indicates a boy. Mom's cravings, whether it's sweets, it's going to be a girl. If it's salty food, it's going to be a boy. So there's like 12 of these things, and they're wives' tales. So to begin with, you have a 50-50 chance of being right. And from there, we kind of narrow it down with the wives' tales.
Now, for those of us who are in the media, we end up doing stories every day, talking to people every day, and it sometimes becomes a blur to the point where somebody would say, who did you have on your show this last week? And I have to think, like, Who did I have on the show last? You tend to forget. It all blends together. I asked that question because, you know, you're the editor of the Farmer's Almanac. Is there anything that has stuck with you over the years, a wives' tale, an idea or a tip where you had something in the almanac that you use in your daily living and it's like, this is a great piece of information?
I think that's good. That's good. In anticipation of the release of this almanac, I actually filmed a few of my favorite hints. One of them was when we did this at my house. I dropped an egg on the ground. You cover it with salt. Just sweep. The salt absorbs the moisture, and you sweep it up, and there, and then it's gone. Cooking fish. I don't do it with lobsters, but I do cook fish in the dishwasher. You take a fillet of fish. You double wrap it in aluminum foil. Put it through the dishwasher. Full cycle, and you've poached your fish.
Wow.
I do a lot of things that are our hints. I don't know if I have any favorites, but there's so many of them that I just keep redefining my life, I think, by hints in the almanac.
And even though, like I say, so many people get the almanac because they know about the weather, I think what you've just described is the main reason for people to get the Farmer's Almanac, and that is there are hints that you can use every day that you would never think to know about, but you find it in the Farmer's Almanac, you go, let me try that.
Well, we have a really good story about hunting, fishing, and the weather, and we talk about under what weather conditions deer are most active, what weather conditions fish are most active, and, you know, it all makes sense. So if you read it, it just helps you when you go fishing or hunting.
And as far as the weather is concerned, not going to it in any great detail, I'll just say for a fact that it's always accurate.
Well, thank you. I was a little less accurate. I have to be honest and have a little humble pie. The El Nino last year did deter a few of my storms, but when they didn't occur, they were usually 200 or 300 miles off the Atlantic coast and just never hit us, even though they were technically there. I think we do a good job. You know, we're doing it 2 years in advance, and we're breaking all of Canada into just a number of regions, so it's not as specific as the local guy is going to be. But I just had a call on Monday for somebody who's going to get married in 2018 somewhere in America, and I told her what the weather was supposed to be, and she was very happy. So, so what we're saying for this winter, however, is that it's going to be primarily cold. We're saying that you need your mittens, your gloves, your snow blowers if you're on the east, and you need your umbrella if you're on the west. So
wow.
I would say that British Columbia will be very stormy. In fact, when you look at the predictions, it's just lots of storms, but I would say more of the rain kind.
Right.
But when you look at the middle portion of Canada, you're talking about freezing, average snowfall, and on the Maritime provinces, cold and flaky, basically, is what we're saying.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. People can find the almanac in stores. They could also go to the website, which is farmersalmanac.com.
Exactly, and by all means, follow us on Facebook. Just like us, and there's just so much activity, and you can get a free newsletter every Wednesday. But there's all kinds of ways to reach us, and I hope our friends in Canada will do that.
Pete, always a pleasure to talk to you. Speak to you again next year, and thanks for being on the
Absolutely.
Program.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Peter.
Pete Geiger, the publisher and editor of the Canadian Farmer's Almanac. You can check out their website at farmersalmanac.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0366, and you'll find the links to their website. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. When the drugstore chain Walgreens proposed merging with a European pharmacy, the move was approved by 97% of Walgreens shareholders. Business experts believe the merger would help both companies, but a group of trial lawyers challenged the deal by filing a class action lawsuit. Even though Walgreens had filed volumes of information required by law, the class action lawyers demanded even more disclosures. Such lawsuits over mergers and acquisitions have become all too common these days. Just 10 years ago, only 39% of these large transactions triggered stockholder lawsuits, but those lawsuits have more than doubled since then. In 2014, a whopping 95% of these deals resulted in a lawsuit. Let's be fair, if these lawsuits were helping consumers, this would be good. But in many cases, stockholders get nothing while the lawyers get rich. In the Walgreens case, a federal court called for an end to lawsuits like this that demand meaningless disclosures and said that they've become nothing more than a racket. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org. Mm-hmm.
from Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holden.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the publisher and owner of the Hardwick Gazette in Hardwick, Vermont. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. And I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you before we get to our next guest. But before I get to that point, just a word on behalf of Elita Hair Products of Beverly Hills. We talked about their products on the program a couple of weeks ago with the man behind it, David Gannon. And we just want to let you know, for fans of the Stuff File program, if you would like to purchase Elita Hair products, you can use the promo code on their website, which is STUFF10. That's the promo code, STUFF10, STUPH10. And that will entitle you to a 10% discount on your purchase. The promo code is again STUFF10. And you can use it at the website, elitahair.com. That's E-L-I-T-A, hair.com. And of course, this program is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, police say a woman who missed the last bus for the night is accused of stealing an ambulance to get home from a hospital in Ohio. Court documents filed in Hamilton Municipal Court in Cincinnati say 43-year-old Lisa Carr is accused of getting into an ambulance that a driver had left running and driving to her home in suburban Cincinnati. The driver apparently had left the ambulance to go inside the hospital with the patient. Police say the Springfield Township woman was arrested after a short pursuit. They say she told them she took the ambulance because she had missed her bus home. Carr is charged with theft, failure to comply with a police order, and driving under suspension. Because, you know, people in these stories never have a valid license. Well, at least she didn't try and steal a bus. I always like to look at the positives in these stories. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Ross Connolly is the owner and publisher of a weekly newspaper called the Hardwick Gazette in Hardwick, Vermont. He's running a contest to get at least 700 essays from which to pick a winner who will then own the newspaper. Contestants are expected to write up to 400 words about their skills and vision for owning a rural weekly newspaper in Vermont. To talk about the contest, we are joined by Ross Connolly from Vermont. Hi, Ross.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for doing this. You've been running this paper since the 80s, correct?
Yes, my late wife and I bought the newspaper in 1986. The newspaper was founded in 1889, so it has quite a heritage. And she died 5 years ago, and so I'm at the point, I'm 71, where I'm ready to retire, and I'm very concerned about the paper being able to continue. And so I decided to try this contest route to see if that might work. I had tried selling it conventionally with no luck, and so I thought that perhaps a contest of only a $175 entry fee might entice some people to give it a try.
So you started this contest when?
June 11, and it was for 2 months. In the rules for the contest, I stipulated that I had the option to extend it for another 60 days if I chose. So the contest first level, I guess you could say, started or ended on August 11th, and that week I put out news that the contest would continue for another 40 days, so it's going to run until September 20th, and hopefully we're going in a good direction. There are some wonderful essays there, so I'm heartened that there are people out there that have experience in both the business side and the news side of journalism, and the passion and drive that they would want to take on this responsibility and continue the Gazette as a weekly newspaper. We publish every Wednesday. It's a paid circulation newspaper. Half the sales are subscription and about half are newsstand. So it's an ongoing business. And one of the things I've learned from the contest in the first 2 months from a number of small business owners here in Hardwick have said, boy, if we could have started our business or bought our business without any monthly mortgage payment, that sure would have put us ahead. And I was certainly that related to me, and my experience, because when my wife and I did buy it in 86, the previous owners financed it for us, so we did have that mortgage payment every month for a number of years, and had we not had that, we certainly would have been in a better financial position to put money back into the newspaper so that somebody who wins this essay contest is going to be in a pretty good situation. It's not to say they won't have the long hours and the hard work, but they're not going to have to worry about making monthly mortgage payments. The newspaper, the building, the equipment, the subscription list, the goodwill, the whole business will be theirs for the $175.
Now, I would assume that you also have a staff at the newspaper. How many people work at the Hardwick Gazette?
Well, we're small. We have, right now, I think, five people on staff, actual employees at the newspaper, and then I have a number of people who are correspondents who cover specific towns. There's an entertainment person, for instance, covers plays and concerts, things such as that. There are a couple, three different people that do sports reporting, and so they do the local high schools, community sports. The Craftsbury Outdoor Center is a world-class Nordic ski area in one of the towns we cover, and so we try to give them coverage too, and the races they have there, as well as athletes that train there and then go on. There are, I think, four athletes who trained at the center and who are from this area who were on the U.S. Olympic team, Winter Olympic team, and so we tried to give coverage of that and give it a local angle as the best we could. And so it's a sparse staff, I guess, but we try to provide the coverage here because there's a lot of news, hard news, entertainment, sports, whatever.
I ask about the staff because I'm just wondering if among the people who are entering the contest, if any of them are are employees that work at the newspaper.
No, under the rules, we said that anybody who had owned the paper or worked at the paper was not eligible because we felt it really needed to be arm's length. If somebody was working here, perhaps that would give them an inside track on moving into ownership, and that certainly would not be fair. We have a panel of judges. I think there are nine people on the judges on the panel who will read and evaluate the essays. The essays are going to be read blind, and we have a numerical system to actually grade them, and criteria we're looking for in the essays. And again, if somebody were working for the paper now or a recent employee, that we don't want to be in a position where they would have an inside edge or give the appearance that they had an inside edge.
How did you go about choosing the nine judges?
Well, they're community members, they're journalists I know, people that I've known professionally for some time, and that I queried them. They had interest in the Gazette, have supported the Gazette in the past, are concerned that the Gazette continue, and trying to get a balance of people on that panel that, as I say, represent community members, are some have journalism experience or are journalists, and others, so that there would be a cross-section there reviewing the essays, and between all of us coming up with a winner.
And how long will you've extended already, as you mentioned, the contest. What is the current deadline to enter?
September 20th. And anybody that is interested in learning more about the contest and Hardwick and the Gazette specifically can go to hardwickgazette.com. That's a web page we created that has the rules of the contest, photos of the area, some of the history of the Gazette, and hopefully provides an overview that those who are curious and interested would find useful.
How far afield have the entries been coming in, to your knowledge?
Well, they've been coming from all over the U.S., and there have been some from overseas as well, but the majority are from the United States. There's some from here in Vermont, other New England states, Midwest, Far West. So it's the South. It's pretty good geographical distribution.
And in reading some of them, I'm assuming you have read some of them already, are you getting people who are in the media, in newspaper business, students coming out of school, people who are looking for a change in career? Is there a pattern as to who is writing in or attempting to win this contest?
Well, it's kind of all of the above of the people you just listed. They're young people that have been in the profession for a few years. They're older people that have been in the profession for a long time and are looking for a change or are concerned about getting a pink slip with the downsizing of some larger news organizations. There are people that are interested in changing careers into this. There's a variety of experience that are demographics, I guess would be a better word, that are being brought to the fore by the contest. And as I say, I'm actually quite pleased with the entries. They exhibit that there are a lot of people out there that do have journalism experience, do have business experience, have that passion and drive, and are very eager to win the contest and become the next publisher and owner of the Gazette.
Since you started this contest, I would assume you've received a fair bit of attention yourself. I mean, here I am calling you from Canada, but I'm guessing you've received a lot of attention from media elsewhere as well.
No question about that. I mean, I'm certainly gratified, not only to you, but to the many journalists who have been in touch. When we launched the contest back in June, almost immediately I was contacted by the Boston Globe, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the New York Daily News, National Public Radio here, the BBC, the CBC also. And there was a radio station out in Vancouver that called, and then numerous media outlets here in Vermont, and so it's been fun to interact with the other journalists who are doing that. I think part of the appeal is we've never found a newspaper that has tried this essay contest. There have been a lot of businesses that have used an essay contest to transition, but this is the only newspaper one, and I think that sparks the interest of other journalists. They like they're journalists, and they're interested in journalism. So we've been getting a lot of attention, and I've received feedback from people I know from all over the country that, I saw an article or heard something about the Gazette. And one of the other things that's quite gratifying, we've received letters to the editor from people not in applying to the contest, but just saying they think the contest is a very good idea. And I've received that from a number of people that I just run into on a daily, weekly basis around here. And invariably, the message is, we think it's a really good idea, and we sure hope that you find somebody, the contest works, because we want the Gazette to continue. And that's certainly important to me, that as journalists, whether radio or print or whatever, we all think what we do is important. But to actually hear from our listeners or our readers that they are telling us it's important, that's a nice affirmation to receive.
People can find out more information by going to the website, hardwickgazette.com. And again, the contest deadline is September 20th. Ross, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
You're welcome, and thank you very much for having me.
Ross Connolly, owner and publisher of the weekly newspaper The Hardwick Gazette in Hardwick, Vermont. Again, the deadline for essay submissions to the contest is September the 20th. For more information, go to their website at hardwickgazette.com. That's HardwickGazette.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0366, and you'll find the links. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
And this week's winner has a video component, which is now posted on the Stuff File fan page on Facebook. Police in Kentucky released video of a bungling arsonist whose Molotov cocktail ricocheted and lit him on fire. The Madisonville Police Department posted a video to YouTube showing security camera footage from the Sunday morning incident at a recently opened barbershop. The video shows two suspects, a man and a woman, outside the building in a white Ford minivan. The woman shatters a back window of the business, and the man emerges from the van holding a lit Molotov cocktail and throws it through the window. The man attempts to repeat his actions with a second Molotov cocktail, but the bottle misses the window and splashes the man with flaming liquid. The suspect sprints across the parking lot to some nearby grass, where he rolls on the ground to put out the flames. And by the way, when you're watching the video, try your best not to laugh out loud at this part. The man exits the view of the camera and then returns moments later, missing a shoe. He takes off a burning sock as he heads back towards the van. The man is seen pouring out another bottle of flammable liquid near the barbershop's door before both suspects flee in the minivan. Now, why? Oh, why? If you're planning to torch someplace, would you be so sloppy with your Molotov cocktail toss that you'd set yourself on fire? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0366. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0366. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberstationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.